All Landry could do was scream. Chapter 61. Lisbon, Portugal, September. Gray was fluent in Spanish, having spent many years working in Central and South America. The bad news was that, as he'd discovered in Brazil many years ago, Portuguese was not as close to Spanish as many would have you believe. He struggled to communicate with locals who did not speak Spanish or English, relying mainly on common words and gestures in order to get by. His train would leave that evening, so he had an entire day to kill in Europe's second oldest capital city. He took a taxi to the Hotel Jeronimos, where he checked his bags and washed his face in the lobby's restroom. Lisbon was physically attractive with its gray, black, and white stone mosaic streets, bright buildings with red-tiled roofs, classic streetcars, and waterfront views. The city's mood was, to Gray, relatively bleak. Citizens shuffled the streets with little joy, and many of the buildings appeared dingy and neglected. Lisbon had the feel of a city whose best days were behind it. Joy radiated from the faces of the numerous immigrants he saw, undoubtedly former residents of Portugal's many former colonies, places like Mozambique, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea. A once mighty empire that had mastered deep water navigation, commanded the seas, and spanned the globe, was now one of the smallest economies in Europe. Only its language left as a mark on its former territories, a faded tattoo as a reminder of what once was. After a cafe breakfast, Gray wandered to the waterfront to see the 14th century Belém Tower, the small Gothic castle that guarded the narrow waters leading to the city. He took some photos with the old green Leica in his shoulder bag before making his way toward the train station for a rail ticket. Purchasing the ticket online was out of the question, since this was the point where Gray would abandon his old identity and assume a new one. As he strolled along the walkway that led from the tower to the shoreline, he tossed his iPhone into the choppy waters of the Tagus River. No part of him felt like turning back. The olive felt fedora on his head and Wayfarer sunglasses on his face would help hide him from the prying eyes of the security cameras and their facial recognition algorithms. His beard, though patchy, was starting to come in. After a frustrating conversation in bad Spanish and even worse English, he was told that he could buy his rail pass only online or at the station from which his train would depart. The ticket agent pointed animatedly at a pamphlet for the Estação de Lisboa Oriente, a station east of the airport and well beyond walking distance. He triple-checked the departure time as 9:34 p.m. local and decided that he would buy his ticket at the station that evening rather than make two trips across the city and back. Gray impatiently explored the city as he passed the hours until his departure, his body adjusting slowly to the time difference. Walking had always helped him fight jet lag, and he logged many miles afoot as he saw the sights, cataloging them with his camera as he went. He bought two bottles of Capítulo, a local red wine, along with some fresh bread and butter for the train ride. After retrieving his larger bag from the hotel, he waited for the afternoon traffic to subside before hailing a taxi to the station. The Oriente station was a modern marvel of white metal arches, illuminated by artificial lighting as the sun set on the opposite side of the city. Gray paid extra for a private compartment on the Renfe train and bought the ticket from a wad of euro notes he'd accumulated over many years of travel in the employ of the United States government. When asked for his passport, he proudly produced a red jacketed book identified in Cyrillic and ISO Latin letters as belonging to the Russian Federation. Thanks to the colonel's contacts, the passport was entirely authentic, but for the name, Adrian Volkov, a man who until this moment had never existed. He ate a small dinner in the station as he waited for the train to arrive, having traded his sunglasses for a pair of prescription eyeglasses. Glancing at the steel Rolex on his wrist, he thought for a moment about the man who had previously worn it, a man who had almost stopped all this from happening before it had even begun, a man he had bested, not with brawn, but with intellect. Boarding his train, he found his way to his small but clean first-class compartment, locked the door, and poured himself a paper cup of red wine, savoring the flavor and the civilized nature of rail travel. The city lights dimmed in their wake as the train made its way into the quiet countryside, small cities and tiny villages visible along their path. Drinking through all of the first bottle and most of the second, he then pulled down both the bunk and the window shade. The train rocked rhythmically along the rails beneath him, and he quickly fell asleep. Chapter 62. Yazidi Strike Force Compound, Kurdistan, September.
Her name was Amy Bertrand.
When the water stopped, Landry began speaking to the empty room, confident that it was wired for sound and that they could hear him. The thick Louisiana accent that he'd worked for years to suppress had returned.
She had long, beautiful black hair and green eyes, stunning. She always wore dresses. She never paid me no mind. Rich girls like that don't even notice white trash like me. Rich bitch is what we called her type. Everybody in school was getting into college, kept hearing her talk about Tulane and how she was going to join her mama's sorority. Tulane, I'd a better chance I ended up in Angola like my dad. He was doing hard time. Girl like Amy Bertrand don't know nothing about no hard times.
Landry paused. His eyes fell to the floor and his voice dropped to a whisper.
She was working in the nursery at the church, holding babies and changing diapers. It was after Mass on Holy Thursday, the day before Good Friday. Everybody's Catholic where I come from, except for the black folks. I snuck in the room behind her where she was in there cleaning up after all the parents had picked up their young'uns. I locked the door real quiet, and she looked up and seen me when she heard the door click. She smiled and called me by my name. I didn't even know she knew my name. Soon as she saw me walk toward her, she stopped smiling. I was a pretty good linebacker. Before she knew it, I tore that pretty little dress right up the back. Had my hands over her mouth so she couldn't scream. I told her I'd kill her and her baby sister if she told anybody, especially the cops. She was down on her knees crying when I left. Guess I should have felt bad for what I'd done to her, but I didn't. I just ain't that way. Never did see her again after that night.
The room was bathed in light as the white LEDs were switched back on, once again shocking Landry's darkness-adapted vision. The muscular and tattooed man, who was ordinarily physically intimidating, now looked like a shell of his former self. He sat with his shoulders hanging forward, his chin resting on his ink-covered chest. The steel door opened and Mo closed it behind him as he entered, taking a seat across from Landry in silence. Landry kept his eyes on the floor.
"What happened then, Landry?" Mo asked calmly.
"My uncle worked for the sheriff's office, and Amy's parents had reported it. Her Miss Perfect reputation would have been shattered in a small southern town like that. No more sorority, no more rich boys lining up to marry her. My uncle and the sheriff made a deal with her old man. I joined the Marines and never come back to town, and they don't press charges. I signed the delayed entry papers the next day, and 2 months later, the Monday after graduation, I'm on my way to Paris Island."
"Who do you work for now?"
"Now, hold on, Mo. You know I need some assurance that I'm not going to prison if I sing."
"Want me to turn the water back on?"
"Just listen, Mo. Just listen. I'm low-hanging fruit. If you want a main enchilada, you know I need something."
Mo took a breath and produced a paper from his coat pocket. Landry's eyes lit up like it was the golden ticket, a way out.
"Verbal acknowledgement is enough. This is the best deal you are going to get. It's not immunity, Landry, but it puts you in a minimum security U.S. prison and gives you the possibility of parole in 20 years. It's a country club. But it's got to be everything. If you leave out one detail, you are going to the deepest, darkest prison we can find. It won't be a U.S. prison. It'll be an Iraqi one. You might even know a few of the prisoners. They'll treat you like you treated Amy Bertrand for the rest of your miserable life. When you're not getting gang-raped, you'll be in solitary confinement until your ass heals enough for another round.
Landry's eyes scanned the document. It looked official, and he wasn't in a position to push his luck.
"I accept,"
he said, nodding at the corners of the room where he assumed there were cameras.
"I accept."
"Talk."
"I was working embassy duty after a couple of Afghanistan deployments down in Buenos Aires. I got to know one of the agency guys there. He wasn't a field spook, just an analyst. I ran into some trouble with a local girl. We was on a date, and she come back to my hotel room knowing what was going to happen. Anyway, this little CIA guy offered to fix it, to make that problem go away. After that, he helped get me the CIA job. He smoothed over my trouble back home and in Argentina when nobody could see the paperwork, and he taught me how to beat the poly. I was making good money working as an agency contractor, and he was getting me cash on the side in a Swiss account. He had me start recruiting you once Reese left the unit."
"Who was the agency man, Landry? What was his name?"
"He had me just call him Bond. Ha! Pudgy paper pusher fancies he's 007.
"So he never told you his name?"
"He didn't, but I figured it out. I'm not as dumb as people think. We both worked for the CIA, after all."
"Name, Jules. What's his name?"
"Gray. Oliver Gray."
Mo looked up at the camera and nodded.
"Does Gray still work for the agency?"
"Sure does. He's working in Langley."
"Was he running this entire operation, or was he working for another intelligence service?"
"Not for another country, Mo. He worked for a person. Some Russian, but he don't live in Russia. He's Swiss now. They call him the Colonel."
"Do you have a name?"
"No. Gray just called him the Colonel."
Mo didn't pursue it, moving from topic to topic to keep Landry on his toes.
"Who is your contact in the Interior Ministry now?"
"Major Saeed, from your old unit. I just pass along the messages from Gray. We set it all up before I left Iraq."
"Who gave you the target in
redacted?"
"Gray did. He gave photos with the layout of the compound and arranged the transport. All I was supposed to do was get Saeed to put his crew in motion and make sure they knew to kill everybody on target. Whoever was at that place must have known they was coming, 'cause them boys never came back."
"Where is your other team? The ones you used in London?"
"I only dealt with one guy, a Syrian. There's sales all over the West now. Their handlers put them to work cheap. They get to get their jihad on, so they're all happy."
"What Syrian? We were both there after Iraq. Do I know him?"
"General Yadid. General Qusim Yadid."
Mo's face betrayed no recognition, but he knew the man, if only by reputation. Formerly one of Assad's inner circle. It was rumored he had left Syria to act as a private broker of mercenaries to places and causes that benefited Assad's regime.
"Where does General Yadid live now?"
"I don't know, I swear. I don't know."
Landry groaned as he thrashed against his restraints. He was a broken man, and he was beginning to lose it.
"How many teams do you have left out there?"
"None. I got nobody out there but you, Mo. I swear it. Yadid, he's got teams all over Europe, maybe even some in the U.S. All I was supposed to do was those attacks to scare the shit out of everyone. Gray had some other stuff going for sure, but I wasn't part of it. He told me to lay low and just keep running you like I was doing.
who set up the Christmas market attack in London?
I told you, the Syrian. I was just a go-between.
Landry, I'm going to be very clear here,
Mose stated.
And I'm going to speak slowly so that even you will understand. Your deal depends on your telling us everything you know. If we find out later that you left anything out, the deal is off, and you become a bitch for life. Imagine how they'll treat an American CIA officer in an Iraqi prison. I almost feel sorry for you, so scan your brain. Is there anything else you want us to know?
No. I've told you everything. Wait! A few months ago, Gray decided he wanted to go direct to Yedid and take me out as the go-between. I'm not sure why. It just exposed him to more risk.
Why do you think that is, Landry?
I don't know. I got the impression that he needed a lot of guys for whatever he was planning, something major. Maybe even 9/11 major.
Tell me more.
Chapter 63. The two SEALs watched the video in the team room, Reese taking notes while Freddy paced the room anxiously. They had watched it in real time, but now reviewed it segment by segment with Mo. Mo pressed the pause button when Landry mentioned General Qusim Yedid.
I know this man, know of him, I should say. He was in charge of finding members of the various resistance factions in Assad's army. His tactics were brutal. If he even suspected someone of being a traitor, he would order the family rounded up and torture the wife and daughters. If the man didn't have a wife, he'd find the mother, or even the grandmother. I'm probably not as squeamish about such things as you Americans are, but even I am disgusted by this man. It was also rumored he was a primary advocate of using chemical weapons against villages with questionable loyalties. Why would Gray take the risk of going straight to this Syrian? Why not continue to use Landry as a cutout? Trust, Freddy guessed. He was losing confidence in Landry? Maybe. Or maybe because whatever they're planning is big enough to blow Gray's cover, Reese speculated. Maybe it's both. Gray is a highly placed agent in the CIA. That would have to be one big mission. That's not typical for a long-term plant. Remember, we are not talking about a foreign intelligence service here, Reese reminded his friend. Now we know that we are dealing with an individual, a super-empowered individual. This is bigger and more complex than we've suspected so far. See what else you can find out, Mo. Landry has to have more in that head of his that can help us. This is potentially actionable intel on a major attack. We need details. Gladly, Mo put down the remote and left the room. What do we do about Gray? Reese asked.
I'll call Vic. He'll get the counter-intel guys on him and start working things from his end.
5 minutes later, Freddy was talking to Rodriguez from the facility's secure conference room.
Gray is a senior analyst at the Russian desk, confirmed Rodriguez. He's had overseas postings in Central and South America. He's currently on leave in Portugal. We just checked with the hotel on his approved leave papers, and he never checked in. No one has heard from him. He's disappeared.
Hanging up the phone, Freddy relayed the new information to Reese.
I don't like this, Freddy. It smells like something moving into a final phase. Gray left before he knew we had Landry, so he wasn't spooked. This was deliberate. Whatever it is will happen soon.
I agree.
Vic is going to do some more digging on Gray. In the meantime, he suggested that we talk